you just woken up. Sure, you missed a very aggressive, very, very hostile first hour of the show this morning.
My goodness.
People are cross.
You'd swear we'd been locked up in Rikers for 24 hours.
You'd swear we'd been to Glen Vista Har. What a rough place Leanne is from. Listen, people are, we've been talking about like schools and fights that break out at schools. And there was a video that went viral over the weekend. Jethro says you need a shambok in your left and a nobkiri in your right hand. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Sanele says if a Dr. Hanan had been on, he would have calmed us down. And James should really get the brunt of this
hostility. I don't know. He was inciting violence earlier.
That's true. There's a lot of incitement of violence. Actually, I'm worried this show is going to be banned by YouTube. So enjoy it while it lasts, all right? We got so much to talk about still this morning. I do want to avoid politics wherever possible because I just I'm so not interested in all the posturing around the election right now. And I know we've still got about 20-odd days to go. I can't wait for it to be over, really.
I'll be voting in Mpumalanga.
Why? Because you'll be on holiday then?
Yes.
But so then you won't be able to vote in your provincial election. Only your...
No, you can. I've applied. You have to apply for it specifically.
Can you?
Yes.
And you've got documents?
I don't know. Again, my brother's organized this.
I don't... Leanne, you're so irresponsible. Like, you just don't, you don't care. And then, you know what you're going to do? Like, 2 days after the election, I know what you're going to do.
No.
Load shedding again. I can't believe this country. You're going to sit there and moan.
I said I would not go on holiday if I could not vote.
No need to get violent. I know where you went to school. What did you say?
I said I would not go on holiday unless I could vote. And so my brother organized it for the whole family. But in any case, I'm going to have to fly.
Poor brother of yours. That brother of yours has to, he just has to do everything.
Everything.
In your family.
I know, I feel very
bad. The rest of you are
bad.
All like a big, you're all like a bunch of lummoxes. You just slow him down. You make his life misery. This poor brother of yours, no wonder he needs to go on holiday all the time. Just get away
He's
from
away
the rest
business.
Of you.
He's away for business. He had to go and fire someone.
This parasitic family who's constantly on his back, forcing him to do all the work.
He had to fly to London to fire someone.
To fire someone? Ooh, that's fun. I'd love to fly somewhere, especially to fire somebody. Call me a
tyrant.
Psychopath. Go on. You know I'd love it. Hi. I flew in this morning. I'm exhausted. Can you see red eye flight? I came here to fire you.
Okay, bye.
Do you have? Can I ask? No questions. I've got to catch my next flight out.
I'm going to Russia to fly. Oh,
so I'm going to Russia to hunt bears.
I was watching with my family for a second yesterday that baking show where it's called Is It Cake? We mentioned this.
Oh, you did tell me about it. No, it actually sounds good. Like, I don't like cooking shows, but this sounds interesting. So they make these hugely realistic.
Yeah. And then they send people in to, okay, so someone might need to make an apple. Someone might need to make an apple, a realistic looking apple. Someone
like the witch from Snow White.
Someone might need to make, and then they go and hide that apple in the supermarkets where it's just, you buy loose apples.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And then someone comes along with a knife. Oh. And we're talking about violence this morning and you get a stab-o-meter or something. And they've got to stab the apple and see if they got the cake or not.
What a waste of good apples.
And cake.
And cake.
And the one guy opens up his challenge. He's from Russia.
Yeah.
His name's like, it's got no vowels. It's like Lil or something. And he opens up his challenge and it's this pack of corn on a polystyrene, like when I say corn, millies.
Yeah.
He opens up this plastic and it's millies. And as he brings it to his face, he sniffs it and he goes, smells like village.
A village. That's beautiful.
I was finished. So yesterday's saying at home, everything we ate, we opened it up and went,
oh, that's so great.
Smells like village. Imagine you were on a date and a man said that to you.
Oh, that's so great. Okay, so I don't want to do any politics this morning. I did see that... Jacob Zuma's disciplinary hearing's been postponed. Who in South Africa is still waiting for the ANC to discipline Jacob Zuma? Who's expecting that to happen? Who's expecting him to take it seriously? Yeah, this is like, Something is so out of control here. The ANC has no... They can't get him in for a disciplinary hearing, even if they wanted to.
Yeah, but look how long it's taken to get Trump into court for Stormy
Daniels.
And
that's also that the horse has bolted, everybody. Get on with it. Like, what kind of childishness is this? Honestly, so stupid. Apparently, speaking of flying somewhere to fire someone, Leanne says there was a flight from Frankfurt in Germany that was turned into a living hell by the passengers. What happened on this flight, Leanne? Well, the passengers, they were throwing up everywhere. They were vomiting violently.
So I do like the heading and subheading of the story.
Go on.
70 vomiting passengers turn Frankfurt flight into living hell.
Sounds great.
Subheading. Imagine being trapped in a puke tube.
Oh.
Miles above land with no way to escape.
So you mentioned these things that you watch on the internet and those TV shows that the realistic cakes and things. I am a regular subscriber to passenger shaming.
Yes.
Do you follow passenger shaming?
Oh, is that an actual...
No, there's a it's not a category. It's one account on Instagram that I follow.
Yeah?
Where they embarrass, well, they hope to embarrass these disgusting people on flights who like take their shoes off and put their feet right next to the head of someone who's in the row in front.
You like look under your arm and you can see the other person's foot.
Yes, or they like fart in the plane and everyone has to hear it. Or they spread their stuff all over everyone else's space, food and. I think, look, flying is revolting.
Yeah.
I don't see it as being glamorous or exciting at all. I've never ever enjoyed, especially in economy, never enjoyed being that close to other people.
And long haul's the worst in the mornings.
It's disgusting. Ugh. People don't, and some people haven't washed.
Mm.
It's just very disappointing. And flight is it's like a big bus in the sky. There's nothing cool about it. These airlines really, you guys are trying your best, I'm sure, to make money. It's expensive. But the kind of people who you'd swear they all come from Glen Vista or something. It's violent, it's ugly, and now you've got vomiting people. Ugh. So I think this would be hell on earth.
Of these people, all 70
people,
70 of them, got the same stomach bug. They were flying from Mauritius, which is a little embarrassing for us.
No, we're not involved. Don't blame us. We're not involved. We have nothing to do with it.
Did they not get their food from us?
No.
Flight DE2315 from Mauritius to Frankfurt. They all had caught the same stomach bug. And we know what happens.
You know what German people eat?
With like Mauritius.
Bockwurst and Knackwurst.
No, they've eaten in Mauritius. So they've all probably eaten at the same
Sega
hotel.
Pudding.
Oh, gosh, who knows? And there were only obviously a couple of bathrooms available.
Two. I mean, this is a huge plane, two.
Yeah.
And now they're all throwing up. Oh.
But by the time this stomach bug set in, they were so close to Frankfurt that they had to just keep going. So they were all just queuing up. They were all just queuing up.
Imagine how the plane started to get that vomity smell after about the fourth person.
Mm-mm. No, if I even hear a person heave, I run. I have to run away. It's my immediate reaction. Like once my mom got car sick and my brother gave her a plastic bag. I had to stop the car and run down the road a block because if I hear it, I will vomit. I would have been a nightmare on this. But no, they all had to just queue. They just spewed their lunch everywhere. Yes, it's been confirmed that the food would have originated in Mauritius. Condor has initiated an investigation into the case to get to the bottom of the cause.
It's disgusting.
It's
those people should never be allowed to fly again.
What? Because they got sick.
Yes. Unacceptable. You hold it in. It's like you can't just...
Have you ever vomited in your life?
Not on a plane. Actually, you know what? I've probably vomited twice in my entire life.
That does not surprise me.
And both times it was in private and I didn't let anyone else know. And I brushed my teeth and washed my mouth out thoroughly afterwards.
gosh, when I vomit, it's, I've said it before, it sounds like I'm being raped by a goat. I have
Get me
to
that
have,
James, I've changed my mind. Bring the shambok. It's not
I have to have the bottom end over something because I could just explode. Like if you had to this drive is, over a
you know,
tube of
there could
toothpaste.
Be, there could be a man watching this now who thought up to about 5 minutes ago, you know, I'd really like to marry Leanne. She's the woman for me. And now after that that disgusting, atrocious description of what happens to you when you're just a little bit ill from maybe a bit of shellfish that's not 100%.
Oysters. I brought up whole guy, oysters once. Oh,
that guy has just done a massive runner. No, no, look. I got to apologize to all the guys who were coming here this morning just to see if they could marry Leanne. They've all run for the hills.
I don't know. Maybe my honesty will still charm them.
No, not now. Not now. That description was appalling.
Oh, goodness me. So, yeah, I'm very glad that you vomit like a lady and wipe your mouth.
I have never, ever thrown up in front of anyone. Ever. I'd be too embarrassed. The embarrassment would kill me. I'd hold it in so long I'd die of that before I'd die of... Oh.
I had a friend
What's wrong
who,
with you?
She had too much to...
No, you people who just vomit on planes and things, have you got no shame?
I've actually never vomited in public. Come to think of it. Oh, I did once with
That took about 2 seconds. Oh, wait, I did once.
Have you ever had... No, you wouldn't have.
Oh, what?
I wish I had another friend.
Go, what else? What were you going to ask?
I had a tequila once, and it was one too many. And it's almost not vomiting, but it just came back up again. So it wasn't from the stomach.
First of all, what a terrible waste of tequila.
No, it was... In the days when you only had like white or gold.
And it was
silver or gold.
It was mostly cane.
Yeah. So yeah, no, that's happened. But
white
I've never
or gold.
Silver. Do you want silver or gold tequila? It was certainly wasn't.
Well, we only had two kinds. I was invited to a tequila fest this weekend. I demurred. I said no. I wasn't I was gonna go and then I changed my mind. No. I decided not to. I'm going to go back onto the like sober for a while thing and see
how.
Because I liked it. I enjoyed that. I don't want to be boring. As I said the other day, worst part about it is how boring everyone else is, right?
Yes.
Phew. Sober people are fantastically bored by you when you're drunk. And I can honestly speak with,
it's very true.
A lot of conviction on this. If you're the only sober person in a room, yes, it's the drunk people irritating. Lucky says, guys, I'm having breakfast. Stop with the vomit topic.
Sorry.
I agree. Gareth sounds like King Charles, says Max Sony. We tried not to sound terribly much like him, but if you insist. I think he probably has thrown up.
Oh.
Wasn't there?
I mean, he's eaten all over the world. Surely he's
Lucky
had something.
Lucky asked us to stop with the subject. Let's move on.
Sorry. Mm.
I'm trying to work, listen to the show, and have breakfast, and you're here talking about your vomiting experience. All right. Lucky will stop, I promise. This morning's show's hilarious, says Janet. The best way to start the week. Well, she's always been very lavatorial, our Janet. No.
Yes.
Mm. I could do the prologue to an alien movie just from filming thrown up oysters.
Do you see? There are. Thank you. I have a friend.
Stop. Okay. The Facebook stream is a bit behind. That's why its subtitles are so perfect. The grammar is great, punctuation and everything. Oh, you watch with subtitles? That's interesting. Do you watch videos?
Can you not understand me?
Yes, your elocution is a little...
A little off.
A little... Well, maybe your timing is. Who knows? There's nothing worse than the delay.
Oh, yeah.
The only time I'll watch a movie with subtitles is if it's in a foreign language.
Oh, no, I always watch with subtitles.
You do?
Yeah. I'm over trying to... Because I'm also doing other things and I have ADHD. I can't just watch one thing.
That's the problem with you. You can't just...
It's
the problem with you. You can't just enjoy, a tequila, for example. You have to throw up as well.
So dramatic.
It's always... Like, you always have to put on a show.
So extra.
Yeah. Extra, extra Leanne. Kings are famous for gorging themselves and vomiting to keep going.
Yes.
That's not true.
Ooh, no, listen.
The Romans used to do that.
But no, and I have family who's done that before. Did I say that out loud?
No, there was, I think I mentioned this the other day, there was a king called Henry I who died of something called a surfeit of lampreys.
Yes, we spoke about that.
And that was because he ate too many eels.
Yes, that was it. Mm.
I've been sober for 2 years now. Lucozi wants some love for being sober for 2 years. Drunk people are extremely boring, the same way that I'm extremely boring to them. Yeah, you know what, Lucozi, you are spot on. So what I suggest is that we have an apartheid of sober people and drunk people. The drunk people all hang out with each other, then they won't judge.
You have to.
Then they won't judge,
to.
Right?
But you know what the thing is?
And Lucozi, if you've been sober, I'll go and hang out with you, and you and I can be boring together, and the drunk people can watch us and go, look how boring, this is.
I must tell you, I was going to tell you this last week.
What?
My colleague.
You waited all week, this better be good.
Yeah, I actually did. I thought about it in the shower.
This better be good.
My colleague has, his aunt has a parrot, right? His aunt got this parrot because somebody went to jail and could no longer have the parrot. And you know these African greys live forever. So this person was incarcerated and she took the parrot from him. But the person who was incarcerated was a drunk and a smoker. And so she records this parrot and sends the sound clips. I will get you one.
Is it rude?
No, it's not rude. It's the coughing and vomiting.
Oh, so it goes, mimics. Please record it. We need it for the show.
I'll get it for you.
That's so great. So this parrot learned those sounds from its
because
former
apparently
owner.
It was kept next to
jail,
the bathroom.
Who's in jail and who used to have a drinking and smoking problem.
Yes.
Wow, that's great.
How funny.
I would love everyone to have an African grey parrot. I wish they were so abundant and cheap that everyone had one. And it would just randomly start playing back very personal and private conversations that people were having in their house.
But imagine if you were
never
like
loved
a,
you.
If you were like a drug dealer or something.
Yeah, I hate the kids too.
Imagine being in the mafia and your parrot starts ratting you out.
Give him concrete shoes. Pull him in the river.
That'd be great.
Oh, Lord.
On the show, says Mapelo, you use so many words like names of places and people that I like to see how they're written. That's why I turn on subtitles.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
Will it come up immediately? Like if I say Drogobosht Godloof. How is that spelled?
I'm going to watch now with subtitles just to see what
Drogobosht Godloof. I wonder how it's spelled.
See if you can get a screenshot of that. That would be fantastic. Okay. Apparently, my apartheid will be a problem. Listen, apartheid's always, it's not a great system.
Never been a good thing, really.
Didn't really work. But Carl says my apartheid will be a problem because the park benches for the drunks will be taken by sleeping people and there'll be fights.
Oh.
Yeah,
but
the
drunks will. How's that spelled?
We're coming up with a lot of words that'll come up beautifully on subtitles this morning. I don't mind being sober, says Iron Megan. Her name is Iron Megan, okay? I mean, either your parents are big Marvel and DC fans, or you're a hardcore bitch. But Iron Megan says,
I will not drink.
She goes, I don't mind being sober around drunk people. It's like watching toddlers trying to talk to each other.
Iron Megan. Beautiful.
Wow.
All right. Well, I mean, listen, whatever you need. Hey, can Leanne remove her bottle from the table?
Oh, geez, sorry.
That's not even the comments. That was the producers.
Oh, that's sorry.
grab your shambok. Just go in there. Sort them out. We've learned this is acceptable on this show. Jethro says, my brother vomited out of the car window while driving on the highway. Wow. That's considerate.
Was he driving?
That's considerate for all the people behind you. Imagine you're just driving, minding your own business on the N1. Monday morning at this time.
No, it would dissipate, surely. On the highway.
Jesus, what bird was that?
Jeez. Listen, no, I've just remembered I've been vomited on.
No. I thought we were moving on from
this. Sorry, just a quick one. You know that ride that you sit in? It was at Gold Reef City and it was called the Coco Pan, but now they've got them all over. Where it starts like this and then.
Yes, I love that thing.
Yeah. Mm. Well, as I was sitting here,
your stomach goes right up into your throat.
I was
fantastic.
Here, and as I was here, someone here vomited.
Oh, so it came. So
and
you,
it went sploosh on all of us. Not great. Not great.
All right. Can you please not stop? I mean, stop.
Okay, we've
vomit.
Stopped. It's done.
All right. Okay, very good.
It's done.
I'm just blown away by the fact that we have someone who listens to us called Iron Megan. That's just the greatest.
Maybe she's been through a lot and she's now strong.
She's made of tough stuff, right? Mm. Okay, very good. Why don't we bring our guest in a little early? Here's his book. So take a look at this, Leanne. This is called Ice Cream, Prescription Ice Cream, Ooh. A Doctor's Journey to Discover What Matters. And it's by Dr. Alistair McAlpine, who tells me that he's just had a little boy, he and his wife. So that's going to be exciting to hear
oh,
about.
Oh, wow.
But I was a bit nervous to talk to him because it says on the back here that he has been a palliative pediatrician. Now, you know what palliative care is, right?
Yes, that's people, end of life care.
Right. And pediatrician means children.
Yes.
So I was like, oh, no, we can't talk about dying children on a Monday morning. That's going to depress everybody. What a horrible topic. And I thought, it'd depress everyone and make them miserable on a Monday first thing. Ugh, wants to do it. But then I suddenly thought, you know what? This guy's probably got some incredible stories of real heroism. You hear about these kids who, like, even though they have short lives, they get to have these amazing stories and dispense all kinds of thoughts that only honesty that children have can be brought about by. Plus, what a brave guy himself to have to deal with that day after day and maintain a positive outlook. I thought, listen, we could probably learn from him.
Mm.
So here he is. He's sitting right next to you, Leanne.
Oh. Yep. Oh. Hello. Hello. Hi. Where did you come from?
From the side.
Nice to see you, Doc.
Thank you very much for having me.
Good. Well, I mean, the book is called Prescription Ice Cream, and you actually have a whole chapter on why ice cream is actually good. I don't know whether to take it terribly seriously or not.
This is the best book ever.
Just tell us about you and your career so far and how you got into this, because I've always wondered about why people choose to specialize in certain kinds of medicine. And palliative pediatrics, that's a tough choice. How did you get to that?
So I trained into my undergraduate at UCT, and I always knew from sort of internship that I wanted to go into pediatrics. I've always enjoyed working with children. Just, you know, they're lots of fun, and always got a lot of meaning and joy from working with them. In the book, and you guys were talking about it, part of my own experience was while I was in medical school, I suffered from a terrible, debilitating bout of alcoholism. And
oh, no.
You know, really, really
at medical school?
At medical school, and actually was suspended because of that and had to go into rehab for a prolonged period of time. And so I know what it's like to be in a mental institution. I know what it's like to be on the other end of a stethoscope. I know what it's like to have judgment against you and to sort of have prejudice. And it's one of the things in the book that I talk about, because in the medical career, in the medical system, mental health issues are rife, and yeah. We just don't talk about it. And so I came out of that really wanting to sort of to try to help people. I actually didn't want to go into palliative pediatrics. I wanted to go into infectious diseases, which is what I'm doing now. But by a sort of a quirk of the universe, there were no posts.
So I had to take what you could get.
And I had been so touched by the palliative service who had helped me when I was in my training at Red Cross, and the amazing work they had done with one of my patients or with a couple of my patients. And I was really inspired, because we're good at treating people. Medicine is good at fixing broken people, but we're really not good at helping people who are going to die and how to help them move on to the next plane. And I just felt really strongly like we do that really badly. Everything we do is geared towards, we need to fix you, we need to fix you, we need to fix you. And if we can't fix you, we failed, and you know, we're just going to walk away. And the truth is, we can't fix everybody. That's just reality. And so for those who we can't fix, we're not very good at then saying, well, how can we help you so that the final stages of your life are not filled with pain and misery and suffering? They're filled with joy and meaning and hope. And that's really what inspired me watching the palliative pediatricians who I worked with. And I thought, that's something I feel really strongly about. I really feel like we don't do this very well, and we especially don't do it well with kids. We all want to run away and hide.
But it is. I mean, it's just such a hard business that I suppose a lot of these kids, they would have like what, you know, leukemia, that kind of thing. It must be just devastating. I can only imagine how hard it would be to go to work if that's what you're faced with every day.
You know, I thought that too. And then what happened was I was working with these kids and they didn't have the same heaviness I had. They weren't filled with this existential angst and doubt and, you know, crushed by sadness. They were upbeat. They were happy. They were smiling. And so I said to them, how can this be? How is it that you guys who are facing mortality at such a young age are able to find such joy and meaning? And so that's what prompted actually my 5 minutes of fame, which is where I said to them, how do you guys find such happiness and joy? And they told me. And it wasn't brain surgery. It wasn't revolutionary stuff. It was basic stuff that we all know, but I think we forget.
So they taught you things.
Oh my goodness, they taught me everything. I'm such an imperfect vessel. I was in many respects a very wounded healer. From what I've said, you know, I'd gone through a lot, and I was on my own journey. And I said to them, "What makes you happy?" So I then created this is back in 2018, a thread based on what they had told me, and you know, I tweeted it off at lunchtime. And, you know, 48 hours it had circled the globe and I went viral and had my 5 minutes of fame. But what they said really touched a lot of people, and the lessons that they were able to impart really resonated with so many. And that's what sparked ultimately the idea for the book, which was, how is it that we find joy, happiness in such tragedy rather than all moping and feeling glum the whole time? Because certainly the kids didn't feel that way. And their message was not for us to feel that way. They had huge capacity for happiness and joy, and they could tell us how to find it.
You've already raised the tone of the show from like all the violence and vomiting and everything else.
Yeah, we started off on a completely different note.
Yeah, we're very pleased that you're here, and I mean it's an inspiring thing to read. But what sort of things did these kids tell you? What kinds of things did you learn from them? I mean, you say that just generally their demeanor is happier and more upbeat, and you know, it's contrary to what you would have expected for people who, you know, have only a short time to go. I suppose we're all just on a death sentence. It just depends how much time you have, right?
Exactly.
So you either accept that and make the most of what you've got, not necessarily knowing how long it is, or you sit and mope.
Correct. And moping doesn't serve anyone well. And moping is not the key to happiness, and the kids didn't mope. So first of all, I think, interestingly, none of them placed any emphasis and meaning on things like Facebook, on things like number of followers, on things like they wish they'd all watched more TV. What they really, really attached meaning to was family time and engaged family time. So time with their family where people are engaged and not sucked into their cell phones the whole time, we're all guilty of, myself included. Actual quality one-on-one time with their families, stories are massive, and in particular hearing stories, reading stories. They just love stories. They love humor. They love farts. They love vomiting. The stuff that you've been talking about this morning.
Yes, the children.
Kids are delighted by that kind of thing.
Now that you mention it, you've found out that was our strategy from the start. We're here to cheer up the kids.
Or that we're still kids.
We're going to claim that we're noble. And our whole purpose this morning was just to cheer up the children. That's why we talked such nonsense for an entire hour and 15 minutes.
They love it. Farting, pooping, weeing.
I've got a book that I need to read to my nephew called it's something about snot. And he's going through a snot thing at the moment. Wow. He thinks it's hilarious. But do you think that children perhaps haven't had the time to place value on life like adults have? You know, when something's been going for so long and you think, what a pity if it had to stop now.
It's called sunken cost syndrome. No, really. It's like those people, and I don't understand this very, very well either. Perhaps there's something wrong with me. But there's people who will sit in a terrible movie, and because they've already sat for 15, 20, 30 minutes, maybe even an hour, they're like, well, I've got to stay till the end. Now I'm in too deep. I get up and leave. So maybe I have a closer and more similar attitude to kids who, like, I'm not going to waste time here.
Yeah.
That is exactly right.
And wasting time is being miserable and moping and feeling sorry for yourself. And maybe also because they are, I mean, they've just come into the world, so everything's wonder. Mm. When you've got wonder and curiosity, you do want to keep going.
Yeah.
You should have written the book. You're absolutely right. I mean, I think that's the thing, is that they don't have, when you don't have much time, things, and I mean, as you say, we all don't have much time, but when you especially don't have much time, you cut through the BS, right?
Mm.
The things that are important are crystallized in your mind. And so they're very good at focusing on what really matters and what is a load of horse shit, quite frankly. Mm. And so much of being an adult, I think, is we get caught up in a lot of stuff that actually doesn't matter, and we forget. And I think why the thread resonated with people is not because it told anyone any great truth they'd never heard before. I think it reminded people of stuff they already know but have maybe just forgotten in their day-to-day stuff. You know, you don't need – it doesn't require some kind of guru to tell you that being with your family is important.
And you mentioned laughter just now, and I think that that's such an important thing. I mean, there's that – there's that brilliant movie with Robin Williams, the name of which escapes me at the moment, where he's the doctor.
Mm. Patch Adams.
Patch Adams, thank you. He just dispenses laughter. And that, to me, was like, yes, now we're getting closer to the truth.
Do you know what I feel like it's...
Make the kids laugh.
We know for a fact that it reduces pain. There's plenty of studies on this. It's almost like the pain receptor, there's pain and happiness, and they compete for the same receptor. And if you're making people laugh, the pain can't go in. And it's amazing how laughter and happiness reduce pain.
It's a lot of pressure on comedians, huh? So a lot of pressure. South Africa's comedians are like, whoa, we've got big work ahead
of
us.
So many people are waking up in pain. We've got to do something.
It's Monday morning.
But that's an interesting observation, that you think they might even, you know, they might not be able to operate at the same time.
I mean, that's not like a big fancy scientific thing. It's just something I've observed. When people are laughing and they're happy, they certainly aren't in as much pain. And we know the corollary is true. We know that when people are sad and unhappy, that pain is worse.
Mm.
Physical pain is worse. And so, you know, they loved laughter. They loved their pets. They love their pets, their cats, their dogs. Yeah. They just love hanging out with animals, even, you know, gray parrots. So they loved hanging out. They loved going places like the beach, going even out just outside, sitting in the sun, on the grass. You know, they love getting out and about, going to the aquarium, wherever it may be, just experiencing nature and experiencing outside. Absolutely love that.
It's that whole theory of our lives are in the wrong order. We should be becoming, looking forward to being a child when we're older.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, maybe one of the reasons that this also appealed to me and why I wanted to talk to you is because I used to be very involved with Reach for a Dream, and they used to do these amazing things for kids. And it's even more amazing that some of their dreams that they wanted to access, do, experience, live for before they exited stage left were actually such simple things. Like, you know, if I want a chocolate cake, or I want to go to the beach, or stuff that most of us take for granted. Watching a goldfish go round and round in a bowl. I mean, it's little simple things, simple pleasures that give people the greatest satisfaction. And if you are at the end of your tether and you're miserable and you're depressed and you're downcast and all that kind of thing, sometimes the smallest thing can make a massive difference.
There's a story in the book about two kids who just desperately wanted to go to the aquarium. And it was a real effort because they were on ventilators and things like that. So it wasn't simply a matter of chucking them in the car and going. You know, you had to have nurses on standby. You had to have people who knew how to. So it was a real, real effort. But it was so worth it because the joy and wonder that they got from just getting out of their stuffy room and getting out and being amongst, you know, the fish and all of the stuff, like, totally worth it. And again, you know, we all know how amazing nature is. You don't need me to tell you, but we need to be reminded.
How about that time that you were visited by gangsters?
So going back to the book very quickly, so the book is in three parts. And the first part is about my internship at Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital, which is a wild, it was for a while the biggest hospital in the world. I think it's third now.
It's over still, 3, it's still beds. An incredibly curious place.
It's, I mean, wild. It's
the you stuff have to drive that happens there to get to places within Barrow.
And so the first part of the book is about what it's like to be a medical professional there. And that's what when I was there quite early, we were visited by gangsters who were the family of an elderly guy who himself was quite a serious gangster. He was unwell. And what was incredible was how I had always felt like we were safe in the hospital, that, you know, this was our place. And the truth was, the minute these guys walked in there, it was their place, and they dictated everything. Ooh. And they just were like,
fix him all.
And it brought up a slightly interesting ethical question, because people are allowed to refuse medical treatments. That's part of being an adult. Oh. You're allowed to say, I don't want you to treat me anymore. Medical treatment is obviously optional. But you have to be in a proper state of mind to be able to make that call.
Right. Mm.
And this elderly gentleman was incredibly confused.
Okay.
And ordinarily would probably not have been in a state where he could have made the decision about his own health. He was quite unwell.
So who
and
did?
And so his family walked in there, these guys with guns, and demanded that we release him. By the letter of the law, we should have refused. But when you're faced with two guys with guns who are not subtle about it, do you really want to stand up? You know, do you really push that and say, I'm dreadfully sorry, guys. You know, your father is not in a state where he can possibly leave this hospital.
So you let him go.
You let him go.
Yeah, I would have done that too, because then it's one less thing to worry about.
You know, I mean, and I don't know whether that was right or not, but I don't know that I was willing to take six in the chest.
No,
exactly. This guy, so
not worth it.
But that's the kind of thing that happens at Barra. You know, it's a wild. It can be a very wild experience, and you can have these situations where no one in medical school prepared you for what do you do when gangsters enter your ward and demand to see you.
Is it harder being a doctor in palliative pediatrics or being a dad? because you did say to me earlier that you've just had your first kid, and the sleep deprivation is a real thing.
I have a cousin who's a pediatric surgeon, and the diagnosis she does on her own son all the time. You can't help yourself. You can't separate being a mother or a father from being a doctor.
Yeah, my fiance, you know, if he's we're both physicians, and if he sort of wakes up in a sweat, she'll be like, he's got a fever, he's got a fever, oh my gosh, got to take him to the hospital. And I'm like, no, I think he's probably just warm in the room. It's weird. It's being a parent and being a pediatrician are two very, very different things. No one prepared me for being a parent. I was very well prepared for how to treat sick children. I was totally unprepared for how to deal with a child who's not sleeping at night or is refusing a bottle or you know, is throwing up every meal you give.
Jumping to the worst conclusions.
I felt well prepared to be a palliative pediatrician, and I feel completely unprepared to be a dad.
Isn't that scary though? Is that the whole world is made up of dads and moms?
What do you mean that's scary?
That they don't. That no one's prepared.
Everybody is.
No one's prepared.
Oh yeah, but that's part of the fun too. And I mean, you also have to think on your feet, even as a doctor. We always assume doctors know all the answers. Sometimes you have no idea, right? Sometimes you're like, oh God, I better go and ask some other people. I better go and look in my books. I better go and spend some time thinking about this. I must do more tests. Most doctors, they don't really know on the face of it exactly what's wrong.
100%.
Okay. We don't expect you to be gods.
And I think if there was sometimes more humility in our profession, that would go down better, because nobody knows everything. And it's totally fine to say.
Well, look how many of you doctors had the shit kicked out of you during COVID, because it turned out that even the people who supposedly knew what they were talking about were completely winging it. These are doctors.
Yeah.
And I mean, that was an embarrassing time, and a lot of credibility was shed, or maybe we just became realistic rather than, you know, treating
maybe we realized that physicians aren't demigods. They're just flesh and blood, fallible, weak human beings like everybody.
And they do get it wrong sometimes.
100%.
You've got to really think carefully about whether you want a second opinion on things. And most doctors will say to you, you can go for a second opinion. I'm not sure
right,
be upset
always.
By you. There are a couple of them who are egomaniacs, I'm sure. But, you know, a lot of them will say to you, look, I'm not entirely sure. Takes balls to say, I don't know.
Hmm. Yeah.
All right. So what's the hardest thing about being in this job that you're in? And now moving beyond the palliative pediatrics into infectious diseases, what's the hardest part of it and what do you love the most?
I would say that the hardest part of it, and I don't know if this answers the question, is how medicine these days, like so many other jobs, is becoming more and more bureaucratic and more administrative. And so those of us who went into medicine with the idea that we wanted to hang around and treat patients now spend most of our days filling out forms, clicking screens, applying to insurance companies for drugs. And so it feels to me like, and this especially happens when you become more senior in your career, I want to hang out with my patients and I want to interact with patients, and everything else is pulling me away from that. And I get more and more sucked into what I find just the incredibly boring administrative side of things. And I think that a lot of people in various jobs feel that way. And so I just hate how the bureaucratization, I don't know if that's a word, has taken away from why so many of us, myself included, got into the job. I don't like filling out paperwork.
So then I'm going to infer that your favorite part is dealing with people.
By far, that's the best bit, you know, to sit there and chat to people and hang out with them and try and make them feel better. You know, you yourself say we don't always succeed in that, but primarily our job is to make them feel better. And when you have such limited time, you've got 30 minutes and you know that 20 of those minutes is going to be spent clicking a computer screen or writing a thing, that means you've got 10 minutes with your patient, which means how are you supposed to possibly grapple with what they're going through when you've got 10 minutes? You know, you can't even begin and to no scratch one, the no surface. One,
well, look, there's some hypochondriacs who will, but most people when they go to a doctor, they really just want to have a discussion about what's ailing them and hopefully have the confidence that somebody who they're talking to is going to help them solve that problem. If most of the time that you are meant to be spending with them is spent doing forms and, you know, sitting in front of a laptop, then that's not what you're there for. It's a total waste of everyone's time.
And I think that feeds into why there has been a general decline in the trust of doctors, because people often feel like they're not heard.
Yeah, you feel like you're being overlooked when a doctor goes, yes, right, breathe in antibiotics.
And a friend of mine, I talk about it in the book, a friend of mine, you know, she'd injured her knee and she was waiting to see the orthopedic surgeon, and she was sitting in the cubicle and he came out from seeing his other patient and he said, where's the knee?
Yeah.
You know, and the nurse was a bit sick. So in other words, in his brain already, this patient with, and she had worried, she was a sportswoman, she was worried that she wouldn't be able to compete. And, you know, so she had a whole bunch of anxieties and things she wanted to talk about her knee, when could she get back? And when she heard that, she just heard, oh, he sees me as a knee.
In number 426,332,
yeah. But then, and then, oh, I don't know, like I was treated like that once by an orthopedic surgeon who said, you're depressed. And a year later, I had to have a hip replacement because he'd misdiagnosed me. So it's like, wow, you know.
That's a hell of a misdiagnosis. It is. You're it depressed is. Hip replacement.
Yeah,
so
because
a lot of distance between those.
Because he was a runner and an athlete. Mm. I was an overweight woman.
Mm. But he didn't listen properly.
Didn't listen properly.
You know, he didn't
give me an X-ray.
Properly.
Just said you're depressed and sent me out, and I had to have my bone cut off because it was sponge.
I'm really sorry about
that. No,
well, it's not your fault.
That's not your fault.
You had nothing to do with it. But
you doctors.
but ice cream, okay, to go back to the title of the book. I mean, listen, everybody feels better with an ice cream. But it's an interesting title because I think it's symbolic of so many of the other cool things that people can do to make other people's lives a bit better. Mm. And this is really where doctors are at their best, is when they can, you walk out of there and you're like, oh, thank goodness, I'm not about to expire.
Yeah, you know? But I mean, even on that, has a patient ever completely surprised you by, you thought that they were going into palliative care and they made it out?
All the time. It's incredible.
Really?
It's incredible how often, again, we get it wrong. You're like, and this is one of the questions people always ask in palliative care is, you know, how much time? That's what, and it is such a difficult question to answer. And people feel sometimes like we're dodging when we say, like, I don't know, because we've had people who are like, today is the day. And then years later, they're trucking on, you know, and or we're like, oh, it's going to be a few weeks, I think.
Well, I mean,
and
a friend of mine got some bad news about his dad, and he was telling me, like, he's not giving up. He's looking into all the different forms of treatment and what could be and couldn't be done. And he spoke to a woman over the weekend who, you know, filled him up with hope that there is a chance. And really, that's like three quarters of the work. If you can fill someone up with hope rather than despair,
absolutely,
that's what ice cream is.
There is a fine line, though, I will push back gently on that, in that false hope is quite an awful thing. So don't give people hope if it's not realistic.
Yeah. Like don't if they're say, flatlining, don't tell say, them there's still a chance.
I can cure your stage 4 cancer if you can't. You know, that because that's cruel. You're providing, and what you are then doing is taking away the focus. If the person truly has a limited amount of time left, they should be aware of that and they should maximize that time, because people will say, I have a few months, it's really important I do the things I want to do, rather than, I'm going to be fine. This is going to be fine. I'm going to take this random thing, and actually, you know, I've got many years left. So I think for me, it's important that you always are realistic with people and truthful to the best of your knowledge, because you don't want to mislead them. And then, because then they're going to feel really upset if something happens. They're going to say, you said it was going to be fine and it was not fine. Why did you say that?
Yeah.
So it's a balance that you have to find. You want to provide hope. You want to be optimistic, but you also don't want to mislead anyone. And with regards to, you know, to the ice cream, yes, it's a bit tongue-in-cheek, but first of all, kids love ice cream. They all love ice cream.
It's always in nice bright colors.
It's bright colors.
Well, as my mom calls it, ice cream. I don't know where that comes from. She says things like that, like sasaw, or are you dating it today?
You know what's cool about ice cream? Is that you can have an ice cream by yourself, thinking about life.
Sure.
You can share an ice cream with a friend. You can share an ice cream with a group of people.
Mm-hmm.
You can share an ice cream while chatting. You can share an ice cream while just being quiet. There's something really uniquely kind of like, it's a little bit, I guess, if you are on that train about like having a beer. You know, there's something unique about it in that you can share it. It's a shared and communal experience.
Yeah, it's also associated with emotion, right?
Yeah.
So you get we always go to this ice cream place, and I lived in a place where one existed along the beach, this ice cream shop that everyone goes to. It's like a destination place and everyone's happy.
Mm-hmm.
Or it could be been stood up on a date, I'm giving up on life, and I have my tub of ice cream and I'm sitting in front of the TV.
Yeah.
It's associated with so much emotion.
It really is. And the other thing, of course, is some of the kids who are on chemotherapy, they have these really painful lesions in their mouth, which is part of the side effect, and the ice cream and the cold and the sugar really soothes that. So I'm not advocating that everyone go and eat tubs of ice cream.
You said prescription.
But what I want to say is that the healing power of sort of a something that, as you say, everybody, or almost everybody, really likes. You know, it provides a lot of joy and happiness. And, you know, that's why ultimately I thought that was the right title for the book, because despite the fact that it deals with a lot of really heavy stuff, I didn't write it with the intention of dragging people down. It's ultimately, I think, a book about hope and finding joy and happiness, even when things are looking pretty tough.
And a nice sponsorship by Sensodyne.
Exactly.
Tell me about the weird things that you saw at Barragwanath when you were working there, because that place is chaos. I mean, it's amazing because it's a miraculous place. But the things that happen there, doctors come from all over the world and they can't believe what you guys put up with.
it almost can't sort of. There's too many things to talk about. But I remember asking a patient to, you know, one of the tests we do for tuberculosis is you have to hack up a little bit of the stuff in your lungs.
Lovely.
And then we send it and we have a look to see if we can see the tuberculosis. And this gentleman was given the thing and he coughed and he coughed and he coughed and he coughed up a worm.
Oh, that's a surprise.
Yeah, exactly. We were all quite surprised. So he coughed up a worm. And the nurse And the nurse took one look and didn't miss a beat and just said, what are we supposed to do with that? Oh. Test the worm for TB.
But what sort of worm was it?
So
like a garden variety?
In South Africa, we have a bunch of worms. That's why we deworm children all the time. And so you get these long kind of almost look like earthworms. They're called ascaris.
Oh, and they live my in God, your... it was in his lung?
No, it was, well, they do go to your lung and then you cough them out into your intestine. This is just great. I hope everyone's finished breakfast. And they tend to live in your just outside of your stomach. And sometimes you
can
don't
you feel them crawling?
No. Sometimes though, if there's too many of them, they form this big ball and then they obstruct your meat, your feet, your foods. So then you have to get rid of them.
We were talking about this last week. I remember growing up.
Everyone is welcome, by the way, for that.
That's lovely.
Description.
Breakfast is finished.
I remember growing up in the 80s. It was all about worms. They were in the pharmacy in bottles. All children were being dewormed. We weren't allowed near sandpits. And it seems to have diminished. Or am I wrong?
We just deworm everybody all the time. So children just get anti-deworming medication all the time.
So ironic. I took deworming tablets this week.
No, you didn't.
I swear to God. I swear I did.
Yeah.
I just decided, good idea. It's a course of 6 of them.
Yeah.
2 a day.
Yes, for 3 days.
Morning and evening.
Yeah.
There we go. See, Leanne.
Not a bad idea if you live in
so
Africa.
So you still have them. I've got rid of mine.
Oh, my God. You know, I mean, Gareth thinks I'm a hypochondriac.
You are.
I'm not. I actually have the thing. I just have a lot of things wrong with me.
We've had in the patients, we had in the hospital, it's so big, patients regularly get lost.
Yes.
They get shunted around to different wards, and I had a patient who got completely lost for 3 weeks. I didn't see him. And then I said he turned up randomly in the ophthalmology ward.
Was he lost in the hospital for 3 weeks?
No, he knew where he was. He was very happy. He didn't go home. No, he was just chilling there getting his medication. No one was seeing
him.
Good
heavens.
And because the wards are so busy that people get rotated all the time. So they'll say, oh gosh, there's no space in the medical ward, so we're going to send you to the, there's space in ophthalmology.
Yeah.
And then ophthalmology's full. So they'll say, we'll send you to orthopedic ward. And so people get shunted around all the time. So patients get lost. don't know where they turn up. Having said that, there's some really, really beautiful things that happen. And anyone who's worked in a public hospital, at 7 a.m. every morning, every single ward stops and everyone sings. The nurses sing, and they sing these beautiful hymns. Mm. And it sounds like professional choirs. And it's one of the most magic things when you're walking through Baragwanath, which has all these different wards sort of
scattered around. Like those terrible songs that they all sang during COVID. They're all like, that was bad. This is just a thing that's always been a tradition at Baragwanath.
And it's not just a Baragwanath.
I've experienced it. It's amazing.
It's absolutely unbelievable. Yeah. They're generally driven by the nurses, and they will stop and they will sing beautifully like a professional choir, and they'll sing a hymn. It changes from day to day. They'll all stop. They'll take a moment. They'll quietly say the Lord's Prayer or whatever. And like, whether you're religious or not, it's just this moment where Barra stops and this beautiful singing comes through. And it's such a unique and kind of peaceful moment. And it's
amazing. I've experienced it as a patient.
Yeah.
And I woke up and obviously I'd been woken up at 5 o'clock to take the medication and everything, but I'd fallen asleep again. And when they started, it changed my entire mindset for the day.
I'm not a religious person, and I find them really quite beautiful.
Yeah.
Just this kind of almost like settling ourselves. So, but going,
it's like everything's going to be okay. We're in control. This thing happens every day. It will happen, and it'll be fine.
Yeah. That's another thing about being a doctor, is that we have to remember also that the doctor is not an automaton, and it must get to you sometimes. And you must have had moments where you've had like an incredibly busy day. I know doctors too. Some of them work very long hours. And eventually you're like, go and sit somewhere when you have 5 minutes to breathe. And you just go, or you start bawling or something, because it's just too much, right? You're dealing with like life and death all the time. The stakes are supremely high. It's not like, I got the spreadsheet wrong, or I miscalculated by 20 cents on
my
this.
My post didn't get enough likes.
Yeah, I mean, come on. Am I right? Like sometimes
happens. I think that's why burnout rates and stuff are so high, because it is constant pressure, constant, often constant sadness, because you remember, like everyone, we don't really remember the patients who do well. We carry with us the patients who didn't do well, who we perhaps made a mistake on because we're human beings, or who had a bad outcome. Those are the ones we carry with us, and it's really heavy. And I think it speaks to the fact why so many doctors are trying to get out. I think in the UK, 1 in 5 doctors is planning on leaving the profession in the next 5 years. 50% of them want to cut down their hours. Worldwide, we're really facing a crisis of people saying, I actually I don't want to do this anymore. And again, sure. There's plenty of books in South Africa, you know, the doctor who walked away. Again, I'm hoping my book will convince people that medicine is a really worthwhile career, but stuff does need to change, because at the moment, I just think that we expect too much, and especially in a country like South Africa and the public sector, where doctors are often the public face of a failing system. Mm-hmm. And that's a huge, you know, when waiting times are long and patients are upset, yeah. you're the yeah. one they shout at, but you're not responsible, because the clinic is, there's too many people for your clinic. That's yeah. that's not your
but
fault.
Do you think overall, is it a two steps forward, one step back thing? Is it progression slowly, or is it regressive?
No. I think that the way we train and treat physicians and look at healthcare personally, I think needs some quite serious overhaul. And it's not just in the South African context. Worldwide, there's a real problem. And if we keep going down, in my opinion, the path we're going down, I think we're going to face huge physician shortages, because I think people are just going to say,
not doing it.
The shit in my
life. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to take the opportunity to say thank you to all the doctors that do good work all across South Africa. And it's always a good idea to speak to one or two of them. And I'm thrilled about your book. It is called Prescription Ice Cream, A Doctor's Journey to Discover What Matters, by our guest this morning, Dr. Alistair McAlpine. It's very nice to see you here, Leanne. Someone says, if Leanne actually had everything that she thinks she did, she'd be dead.
It's a miracle I'm alive, because I have all those things.
You see? All right. Well, you're going to get some consultation time just after this with Dr. Alistair. Thank you, everybody. That's it for us for today. We will see you tomorrow at 6 a.m. Oh, no, wait. Big announcement.
Oh, yes.
Dun, 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 dun. Yeah. So what we've decided to do is we've decided to do Mondays, Wednesdays, Fridays. So starting from this week, I know it's a bit of a shock to some people.
Sorry.
Changing your life again.
8:01, you know.
Monday, Wednesday, Friday for the show. We will still be doing a Burning Platform special on the podcast party on Thursdays. So you still get your 4 days a week, but the live show Monday, Wednesday, Friday. You knew it was coming. It was just a matter of time. I've made the decision. What are you going to do? What do you do? You can't chain me to the chair. There we go.
Get over it. Have some ice cream.
Right. Now let me go and beat the producers. Have a happy day, everybody. We will see you on Wednesday.